The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The Senate hearings for Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the Supreme Court left Democrats grasping. Senator Ben Sasse gave them a civics lesson.
This is supposed to be the apolitical branch, and that shouldn't be a Republican argument. It should be something that Democrats also want to argue for.
For the most part, Democrats seem to have received the message. Judge Barrett's faith is off limits. So they tried to hammer her instead on health care.
It is not Judge Barrett's role or the Supreme Court's role in our constitutional system to set health care policy. It's Congress's role.
As usual, polling in the presidential race has been greeted with skepticism. Mike Gallagher sorts through the latest from Gallup.
A whopping 56% said yes, they are better off now. 56%.
And Joe Biden waffles on domestic oil extraction.
No fracking for a year and a half, right? And then he goes to Pennsylvania and says, no, there'll be fracking.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. Judge Amy Coney Barrett, President Trump's nominee to fill the seat vacated by the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, was on full display this week before the Senate Judiciary Committee. She was unflappable, focused, intellectually brilliant, full of energy. Democrats have been struggling to find an approach to dealing with her confirmation. Some Democrats have gone to the length of arguing that filling the vacancy left by Ginsburg's death with an originalist is somehow court-packing. While their own presidential nominee has struggled to repudiate the genuinely radical notion of real court packing. Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska used some of his time to educate his peers, including pointing out that the number of seats on the Supreme Court has been 9 since 1869. Sasse was a guest on my program. When people talk about court packing, and they won't even admit what it means, they are undermining the fundamental rule of law. I get very exercised about this, Senator. They should not, if they're going to try and pack the court, they ought to at least be upfront about the danger that it poses.
Yeah, I mean, the structure we have, these three branches that check and balance one another, it's fragile. And if you end the deliberative structure of the United States Senate and you do that for the purposes of packing the court, you're really fundamentally remaking the American system. And we got lots of stuff that's broken in our public life and public square and civil discourse and public trust right now. And it's an incredibly dangerous thing to do. I think it's a terrible idea, but at least be upfront with the American people. And instead, they've decided to come up with this dodge where they just have this Orwellian spin by saying, well, we know that in our focus grouping, court packing is a term that nobody likes. So why don't we just say the other side did it? So now they're talking about filling open vacancies as court packing. Are you kidding me? I mean,
when Leader McConnell blocked all of the Democratic judges in the last 2 years, it was payback for Harry Reid breaking the filibuster. I mean, that was just the quid pro quo of the Senate. And I don't know why we can't admit that. And you know, the Senate is a majoritarian institution when it comes to nominations now. That's Harry Reid's doing. But what I really worry about, and I'd like to have your thoughts on this. People always think I'm an alarmist when I bring up the Roman Revolution, which actually it takes 70 years for Rome to lose its republican status because of continued assaults on the mos maiorum, the way that things were done, just continually assaulting traditional norms. We're going through that right now, and people don't understand. You can't shake the pillars without bringing down the house.
I strongly agree. I mean, when I was running in 2013, 14, one of the most common topics on the trail was the Waters of the U.S. rule that was about the EPA and, you know, trying to remake the way we regulate agriculture, even when it's intrastate issues. But I'd say a close second was executive overreach. And executive overreach follows from legislative underreach. So now going back to your Roman history, if the Senate just becomes a place that seems like a nice honorific, it's a title people want, but it's not an institution that wants to actually work through the hard choices and trade-offs that have to do with public policy and power, if it just becomes a place where people grandstand because they want your job, they wish folks here wish they could be pundits instead of actually having any influence over the legislative decision-making that's happening, then inevitably you're going to grow an administrative state. Inevitably you're going to grow an executive branch. And the public then starts to think of the presidency as this quasi-kingly power. And when you do that with majoritarian 51-49 voting, it means that all of culture has to be swallowed up by the politicization of, I got to get to 51-49 because otherwise the world's going to end. Washington, D.C. is just not supposed to be that important in people's daily lives.
I hate the missed opportunity. Justices come out for questions once in their life. And to use it for political grandstanding instead of the education of the American public about what judges do is, to me, tragic.
I agree. We have to have people understand what judicial activism is, why it's bad, and why putting on a black robe, cloaking yourself, is all symbiotic with not standing for election. It's symbiotic with lifetime tenure, because this is supposed to be the apolitical branch. And that shouldn't be a Republican argument. It should be something that Democrats also want to argue for, so that the political branches have the accountability to the people.
For more of that conversation, go to townhallreview.com. For many weeks, the polling average of Real Clear Politics has shown former Vice President Biden with a comfortable lead over the president. But Republicans are still holding out hope that the numbers are wrong and will be proven so soon. Mike Gallagher took a look at a piece by Byron York in the Washington Examiner.
Byron York's daily memo over the Washington Examiner. He writes, every day some new poll is published showing Joe Biden with a big lead over Trump. Some Trump supporters ignore the news because some of the polls were wrong in 2016. Byron says they shouldn't. The polls are real. There's no doubt Trump is facing a serious challenge. But those polls don't tell the whole story, he writes. Recently, we've seen a number of indicators to suggest that the race might change in its final 22 days. Start with a jaw-dropping number from Gallup. In a survey that was taken September 14th through the 28th, Gallup asked voters, would you say you and your family are better off now than you were 4 years ago, or are you worse off now? A whopping 56% said yes, they are better off now. 56%. Remember, the poll was taken just a couple of weeks ago. After months of anxieties associated with the coronavirus pandemic, the lockdowns, the accompanying economic plunge, and a solid majority still said they're better off today than before Trump was elected. And in July of 84, before Reagan was reelected in a landslide, 44% said they were better off. So as Byron York concludes, Trump's 56% is better than all of them. Also, normally one would expect a president in office at a time when a strong majority felt better off than 4 years earlier to be in a strong position for a second term. Yet Trump is trailing Biden by 9.8 percentage points in the Real Clear Politics average of national polls, and is also behind, by various figures, in key battleground states like Florida, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And then there's this. Gallup asked, please tell me whether you agree or disagree with Trump or Biden on the issues that mean most to you. 49% said they agreed with Trump on their most important issues, while 46% said the same of Joe Biden. Byron York writes, in part because so many voters say they're turned off by his personality, his manner, his style, his public performance in office. In the same poll in which 56% said they're better off than 4 years ago, Gallup also asked whether voters agree or disagree that Trump or Biden has the personality and leadership qualities a president should have. 49% say Biden has those qualities. 44% said Trump has them. There's a great irony of Trump's status, he writes. He had an advantage over other 2016 contenders because of his celebrity. Now he's struggling, Byron York writes, because even though he can point to solid accomplishments, he has not given some Americans the performance they want. And that, more than issues, might be the deciding factor in 2020. So it's a mixed analysis, but it kind of suggests that this race could change dramatically over the next 22 days.
Throughout the course of this campaign, former Vice President Biden has embraced the agenda of the hard left. He's boasted of getting tough on carbon while getting in line with the Green New Deal. If we go down that road, America would lose our energy independence. Fracking would go away. I spoke about this possibility with the president's energy secretary, Dan Bruette. I normally, and I will, talk with you about nuclear power this morning, Mr. Secretary, but I want to start with fracking because the president talked about it in Pennsylvania.
But think of it. You know, you talk about politician, no fracking for a year and a half, right? And then he goes to Pennsylvania and says, no, there'll be fracking. Like nothing happened. Can you imagine if I did that? No fracking. I'm the opposite, by the way. No fracking. But all of a sudden he comes out in favor of fracking.
Yeah, so, Secretary, what do you think about fracking? How important is fracking to the American economy?
The president is exactly right. It's not only important to Pennsylvania, it's important to our entire economy. Everything we use today, Hugh, almost anything you can put your fingers on right now is probably made from a petroleum product. Well, guess what? The feedstock for that petroleum is natural gas and crude oil. And the reason that we are the number one producer in the world today is because of the technologies that have been developed over the years, and that includes fracking and horizontal drilling. If we deny this technology, if we deny this expansion of production in America, we're denying Americans not only these products, but the jobs that go along with them. And that's why the president was spot on when he was talking in Pennsylvania about this important technology.
We can't talk about fracking enough because it's the livelihood and jobs of millions of Americans. I don't know if the Department of Energy, Mr. Secretary, has done any analysis on how many jobs depend upon fracking. Anything come to mind?
Yeah, we have. I mean, it's an enormous amount of jobs. I'll tell you just real quickly, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce tells me that roughly 19 million jobs in America today are dependent upon this technology. So think about that for a second. You remove this technology and 19 million jobs go away. That's both in the energy sector and all the derivative products and derivative industries that come from this important industry. So it's absolutely essential that we continue this type of progress with regard to technology. But also, Hugh, you know, the important point here is that this is the technology that has allowed us to become the number one producer of natural gas and oil in the world. We are now larger than Saudi Arabia and larger than Russia. We are now energy independent. And we cannot, at this point in time, take a step backwards and become dependent upon these countries in the Middle East, many of whom don't have our interests in mind.
Coming up.
It is not Judge Barrett's role or the Supreme Court's role in our constitutional system to set health care policy. It's Congress's role.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. As the hearings for Judge Barrett moved into their closing days before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Baird remained calm, clear, unflappable, her intellect shining. Senate Democrats kept trying to hit her on health care, the Affordable Care Act, and whether the justice would do something about provisions for pre-existing conditions. I spoke with Senator Tom Cotton about the proceedings before the Senate Judiciary Committee. I wanted to talk to you about pre-existing conditions because I listened to the Senate Judiciary Committee, of which you are not a member, yesterday, and I was frustrated because I am unaware of even one Republican senator who wants to exclude pre-existing conditions from any health reform going forward. Is that a straw man to end all straw men?
Yeah, of course it is, Hugh. And of course, Republicans want to protect every American's coverage, whether they have a pre-existing condition or not. But I got to say, you said you watched the Senate Judiciary Committee. When I tuned in, I thought I'd stumble into a hearing of the Senate Health Committee.
Yes.
Because the Democrats kept talking about Obamacare, and they didn't talk at all about the law or about the Constitution. It is not Judge Barrett's role or the Supreme Court's role in our constitutional system to set health care policy. It's Congress's role, working with the president. And I suspect that Judge Barrett will remind those senators today that the Supreme Court doesn't decide health care policy. It's Congress. Now, Congress made a lot of bad mistakes with Obamacare. That's what forced insurance rates up so high. It's what taxed individual Americans with a penalty because they couldn't afford the insurance that Obamacare made unaffordable in the first place. The Democrats don't want to talk about those problems with Obamacare. They want to focus on this straw man that the Supreme Court is somehow going to take away people's health insurance. Of course, that's not going to happen. The only thing that took away people's health insurance is Obamacare. What the Republicans want to do is protect coverage for every American, including those with pre-existing conditions, but make that coverage more affordable, make that coverage more personally suitable for each individual family.
And I do believe they decided from some focus group, but I think that focus group was drunk. Because if they thought that was effective yesterday, it just wasn't. Our side had very effective, ours being Republican, had very effective appeals to the tradition and norms of the committee. Now, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, when she appeared in 1993, developed the Ginsburg rule, which is that a nominee must never comment on a matter that might come before the court or is a live controversy. Do you believe, I do, but do you believe that prevents her from saying that she will recuse herself in any controversy? Because that is to decide the controversy.
Well, yes, Hugh, because there is a legal standard in the federal code that determines when a judge should or should not recuse herself. But more broadly, Hugh, I would simply say, of course, a justice cannot recuse himself or herself simply because the president who nominated that justice is a litigant or his administration is a litigant. Otherwise, you'd have people recusing themselves for years and years. So, of course, Justice Barrett, once she is confirmed, should not recuse herself simply because Donald Trump or his campaign or his administration is a litigant. Now, that's not to pre-decide any specific question, but as a general matter, justices have always decided cases involving the presidents who nominated them.
And I believe then a litigant would be deprived of a fair opportunity to make their case on recusal or against it when it arose. Last question, Senator. I may bore my audience to death, but the prospect of court packing is chilling. It is destructive of the republic. I can't believe Joe Biden won't renounce it. I can't believe your colleagues are trying to talk about it. When will the Senate bring this to the floor and dispatch it? Because honestly, I'd like to see a test vote on this.
Yeah, I'd be happy to vote next week when the Senate's back in session on whether or not we should expand the court by two or four or six justices. Let's see what the Democrats think before they know the outcome of this election.
Rick Date served as deputy campaign manager on the 2016 Trump campaign. I've gotten to know Rick in the last month, and his knowledge of political campaigns is substantial. Rick has just come out with his new book detailing the campaign as well as his involvement with the special counsel, his plea of guilty. The title, Wicked Game, an insider story on how Trump won, Mueller failed, and America lost. We spoke last week on the Hugh Hewitt Show. And now Wicked Game comes out right in the middle of a campaign. It is the first insider account of the 2016 campaign. There have been a lot of books written about President Trump, a lot, but no one who was inside the campaign. I want to start with the big reveal for me that on television, you were outspent by a lot, but your investment on online proved to be decisive and nobody saw it. Can you walk through that? Because I believe you said that you only spent $47 million online, but you got 10 times the value online.
Absolutely. It was a dramatic shift in how campaigns approach elections. And in this case, we had a data and digital director that was not a political insider. In fact, he was from San Antonio, had an internet company, and we acquired him on the campaign from the Trump Organization. And he had a completely different view of how to look at digital and social media that no political campaign had ever looked for. So the idea that we could target individual people in cities, in local precincts, and actually send them material that pertained to issues, effective way to get to them. So we could produce up to 150,000 digital ads a day, send out across the country, and it cost a fraction of what a traditional TV ad would cost.
Is that going on right now, Rick Gates? In Wicked Game, you suggested that a lot of people were unaware of the digital game that Team Trump put together. Is there a similar unawareness in the media now?
Yeah, absolutely. And this time, the Democrats are much more aware of it. That was one of the big takeaways from the 2016 election, is that Hillary Clinton had about 200 people just on her digital team. We had a grand total of about 20. And from the results of the election, it was very clear that one of the significant ways that Donald Trump was able to effectively communicate his message was through the digital medium.
The other thing, I think anyone who loves campaigns is going to love Wicked Game, because you, for people like me who don't really know polling, all I can do is read the results. You, Rick Gates, take us in Wicked Game inside Tony Fabrizio's hiring and his input into the campaign, especially the importance of a candidate's negative rating. What it means to have a negative 85, which was Hillary's negative rating, and what do you think Joe Biden's is?
I think, you know, from Tony Fabrizio's perspective, we had worked with him in the past on polling in the U.S. and in other countries. He had a very interesting story. He approached President, then candidate Trump, and had said, I want to bring in a pollster. Now, the president doesn't really believe in a lot of the polling data. When Donald Trump was running for governor in New York, he had reached out to Tony Fabrizio to see if Tony would consider doing the polling. So when Paul approached Donald Trump with the idea of bringing Tony in, the president went kind of was very upset, very angry. And we couldn't really understand why, because we didn't know there was any backstory. We learned the backstory. Nonetheless, President Trump allowed us to bring Tony on. And it was just staggering to see that her untrustworthy rating was so high, because never in kind of the history of presidential races would you ever have somebody that high of a untrustworthy negative rating and still be a contender for the presidential seat.
For my complete interview of Rick Gates, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up, the price of panic.
Then you look at the costs, and the costs are absolutely astronomical.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. It's been some 7 months now since we were first hit by COVID-19 pandemic in the United States. The nation is only now beginning to return to normal. A timely recent book, The Price of Panic, analyzes the effects of this pandemic from a number of angles. Three authors collaborated on this project, including Jay Richards of the Discovery Institute. The book's subtitle is telling, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned the Pandemic into a Catastrophe. Richards was a guest of my friend Dennis Prager.
There's no signal in the noise of the curves, the different death and case curves for government lockdowns. You wouldn't even know when the lockdowns happened if you sort of map this out as we do in the book. So that's the really bad news, is there probably was no benefit. Then you look at the costs, and the costs are absolutely astronomical.
I was reading from the Jerusalem Post the staggering statistics in Israel. Of increased child abuse, suicide, drug addiction, et cetera, because of the lockdown.
Absolutely. Israel is one of the countries that has just gone all in on the lockdowns, unfortunately.
Same, right.
In New Zealand. You know, and so it's basically Israel and the Anglosphere have gone all in on this. We have some countries in East Asia, like Taiwan. William Briggs was there, by the way, the entire time we were writing the book. In Vietnam, which actually had very few deaths. And fortunately, in the United States, we have a federal system, and so different states did different things. That's terrible if you're in California. That's great if you're in Oklahoma or Florida. But for us, it was helpful because it allows us to actually test the hypothesis about the effects of the lockdowns, because we can compare different states. And what we discover is that, no, the lockdowns just didn't make any difference at all, so far as we can tell, on the spread of the virus.
The subtitle is as important as your title. The title is The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. I want you to know that as soon as I see the word expert, my emotional reaction is I assume they're fools.
I think that's actually the right emotion at this point. Now, of course, people have... can have an expert who has a very narrow specialty, and within that specialty, you know, if you're wondering some specific question about epidemiology, ask an epidemiologist. Very few characters, the director of the World Health Organization, and of course now famous Dr. Anthony Fauci, who just happened to be in the right place at the right time. They had expertise, just as Neil Ferguson at the Imperial College London had some expertise in modeling, but it was his model that told us that we were dealing with about a 3.5% infection fatality rate. World Health Organization jumped on that. Anthony Fauci jumped on that. And then he happened to have the ear of the president of the United States. The president, of course, has inherited him from the sort of career deep state that you have when you come into Washington, D.C. He's the only one, you know, basically his only advisor. And he's the one that told President Trump we're going to have 2.5 million deaths unless we lock down the country. That's the tyranny of experts, in which two or three people with very narrow expertise were giving advice about what the president should do for a country of 330 million people. That's something that we don't want to have happen again.
Oh, it's going to happen again. There was an article, I forgot where, but in a mainstream source, that this lockdown is a dress rehearsal for the Green New Deal.
I find that at least plausible. At the very least, that this wasn't in plan, but at the very least, people who have designs for control of the global economy certainly now know what it takes to get Americans to comply. Beforehand, you might have thought, well, if we had been told we had to stay inside for our own good, we would have all rebelled. But instead, we were told we need to stay inside and lock down and stay out of worship services for the good of our fellow human beings, the good of our fellow Americans who are more vulnerable than us. And so we were sort of hoisted on our own moral petards. Our own concern for other people during the lockdowns, unfortunately, was used against us.
Well, that will be done with global warming. As I said from the beginning, we are told that global warming is an existential threat to life. If we lock down for 1 million lives, why wouldn't we lock down for 6 billion lives?
That's the exact argument I think that we can at least anticipate. It's one of the reasons I think we need to learn what's happening in this case, because in both climate change and the pandemic, we were taking advice based on predictive computer models that we had no reason to believe in the beginning. It's one thing if a meteor hits planet, we have to have some kind of emergency measures. At least we know we're addressing something, a real and present danger. In the case of the pandemic, we reacted based upon projections that were based entirely upon computer models. And so even President Trump, unfortunately, is still saying, well, 200,000 may have been lost, but we saved 2 million lives. We probably didn't save 2 million lives. That was based entirely on those, we now know, bogus computer
models. That's exactly
correct. And
we're
going to be playing the same game with climate.
That is exactly right.
Coming up.
Trump reacted very aggressively, cut off Chinese flights, etc. People like Biden and Pelosi and Harris were attacking him the entire time.
Newt Gingrich on The American Future. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich was the House leader during the Republican Revolution way back in 1994 during the Clinton presidency when Republicans rebounded powerfully at the midterm elections. Gingrich was the primary architect of that revolution, and he's been pro-Trump from the beginning. He's out with a new book, The American Future. Newt sat down with my Salem colleague, Sebastian Gorka.
Shouldn't a hearing on a Supreme Court justice of either administration, either party's nomination, be about the actual nominee?
One of the great virtues of our system is that elected officials can do what they think works for them. Now, the Democrats, looking back on the backlash from Kavanaugh, which probably cost them 4 Senate seats. So they had to double down because you can't deal with a mother of 7 children the way they dealt with Kavanaugh. So they had a second problem. And they're the party which is really big on mansplaining. So it's really tricky for a Democratic male to attack a female judge. So they ran the risk that she would just beat them if they got into a debate. And they then did something which I think was very, very smart if you're a Democrat. And they're very well disciplined, much better than Republicans. They're willing to work as a team. And as the collectivist party, they have deep habits of doing things together, whereas we as the individualist party find it really difficult to get our side on the same team. So every single Democrat had a picture of a constituent who was suffering from a precondition. You know, out of their 10 minutes, they were going to spend 5 of it on how wrong this process was, attacking Donald Trump, and then 5 of it on their fear about the Affordable Care Act, preconditions, and this wonderful constituent of theirs who was suffering personally and who the Republicans would just abandon and betray. It's not an irrational strategy. Now, to your point, I think it also came because I think the Democrats know this is over. Barrett is going to be confirmed. You're going to have a 6-3 conservative Supreme Court. Trump will have defined the Supreme Court and the senior courts maybe for as long as 40 years. I mean, Barrett's only 48. So she could easily be on there for 40 years. And that's why you have on the hard left such a desperate desire to pack the courts, because I mean, they're sitting there looking at the idea that no matter what happens in the election this fall, they could be dealing with a conservative, constitutional Justice Scalia court for 4 decades. And it's just driving them crazy.
What is your reaction? I'm just going to leave it completely neutral to both Kamala Harris and then Joe Biden twice saying, I refuse to answer the question on packing the court, because then my answer will be the issue, given that we are exactly 3 weeks away from the election.
Biden is desperately trying to get to the election. He knows that by better than 2-1, the country does not want to pack the court. But he also knows that that one is his base. So if he's not careful, he could have a total rebellion on the left. And so on the other hand, he knows if he came out and said, yeah, I'm for packing the court, he'll lose the election because by better than 2-1, the American people oppose. And they think it's a big issue. They have some deep instinct, despite 2 generations of really bad education. They still have a deep instinct that it matters to have a Supreme Court that's independent. So I think that's what they're trying to do. And of course, it's compounded because, you know, I tell people, I was comforted yesterday when Biden announced he was running for the Senate. I think he could be a senator. It's relatively harmless. I don't think he can be president. And I do think you're going to end up with a Harris-Biden administration because she has so much more energy. She's so much more aggressive that she will basically define a large part of the administration from day one. I think that, you know, I don't think the media is going to let him get away with it. And that's been a surprise to me. This is the first issue I can remember in this campaign where the media actually is going after Biden across the board, and even CNN. is giving him a hard time.
How does the president catching the Chinese virus and being declared to be free of the coronavirus affect this election?
Well, I think if he continues to educate the country, it'll be actually a net asset, because we now have the World Health Organization saying that masks are wrong. You have over 6,000 doctors who signed a letter saying that masks are wrong. And it's about to turn out, if you want to talk about science, Trump's doctor has said that he is completely free of the virus. The left, of course, talks about science, but they basically follow some form of voodoo and have no scientific basis for anything they're doing. And I think that's part of the contrast he's trying to draw. That's why he's going to events and in a sense, taunting Joe Biden. And I think I just did a YouTube video actually on saving 2 million lives, because I think the real story is that when this began, experts said more than 2 million Americans would die. Trump reacted very aggressively, cut off Chinese flights, etc. People like Biden and Pelosi and Harris were attacking him the entire time.
Millions of lives saved because of a very, very early decision by the commander-in-chief. Speaker Gingrich, do we have to fear the know-nothing movement of the past is being resurrected like a zombie? Is there prejudice against Catholics in America today?
Sure. I mean, I think on the secular left, you have a lot of people who are they're anti-Christian. They're anti-Orthodox Jew. They're anti-Catholic. I mean, look at people have not covered him much. If you look at what Cuomo's doing in New York, I mean, he's in an open fight with the Orthodox Jewish community. And apparently yesterday actually welded shut the gates to a cemetery to block people from going to have a Memorial Day observance for a rabbi who had been very important in the history of their community. So I think you see this all across the country.
Coming up,
when will Trump be getting an apology from the people who claim that he responded to the coronavirus pandemic irresponsibly?
Larry Elder on Trump's vindication when we return with the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook. And in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, the hearings for the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett begin. She was impressive.
I think she comes across as a cut above in the sense that she's too good for the Senate.
All Americans should be able to agree on her core convictions.
Her agenda is to maintain the integrity of the Constitution.
They'll look at the threat of judicial activism.
Legislators have to face the voters again and again and again.
And at China's increasingly threatening posture.
They don't want Christians to leave out their faith.
You'll hear from Rod Dreher on the challenges to people of faith right here in the United States.
And you're going to find it increasingly impossible to participate in public life.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Recently, the World Health Organization urged world leaders to stop using lockdowns as the primary method of pandemic deterrence. President Trump may have been proven correct when he pushed to get the economy open again, even as he continued to fight COVID-19. But of course, this won't stop Trump's accusers from pointing to his response to the pandemic and declaring it to be inadequate. Here is Larry Elder.
When will Trump be getting an apology from the people who claim that he responded to the coronavirus pandemic irresponsibly? As recently as September, Dr. Fauci said, Americans should prepare to, quote, hunker down, close quote, his word, not mine, until 2021 in order to combat the spread of the coronavirus. Now, I thought the whole point behind the initial suggestion that we lock stuff down was so that it would be very temporary so that we could, quote, flatten the curve. The idea was that we don't want a whole bunch of people rushing into the ERs at the same time because it would exhaust our ability to handle it. The idea was to flatten the curve and smooth things out, not to cure this because there's no cure, not yet. No vaccine, not yet. The idea was to buy time for cures, buy time for vaccines, make sure we don't overstress our healthcare system. Now you have a petition. Get this. Over 6,000 scientists have signed a petition calling for the end to coronavirus lockdowns. And from this petition, quote, as infectious disease epidemiologists and public health scientists, we have grave concerns about the damaging physical and mental health impacts of the prevailing COVID-19 policies, and we recommend an approach we call focused protection. It was signed by over 2,800 medical and public health officials and scientists, 3,700 medical practitioners, and over 60,000 private citizens, according to Newsweek. The petition reads, quote, current lockdown policies are producing devastating effects on short and long-term public health. Keeping these measures in place until a vaccine is available will cause irreparable damage, with the underprivileged disproportionately harmed, end of quote. A study was conducted by something called Just Facts in May. It concluded that stress and anxiety from coronavirus lockdowns could destroy 7 times more years of life than the lockdowns save. I repeat, a study concluded that stress and anxiety from coronavirus lockdowns could end up destroying 7 times more years of life than the lockdowns save.
Thank you for joining us on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, Harley Eide, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for joining us.